Spirit Blade Underground, episode 378. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 378.
Hello and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and community you can check out at christiangeekcentral.com. I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to hopefully equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ. For more info and free goodies, check out spiritblade.com. On the show today, I'm going to just vomit out some thoughts on you on why I think DC Comics kind of sucks for me right now, and how to fix Superman. And Ken from Honolulu is stopping by to review Big Ass Spider. And then lastly, we're going to get back in the book of Hebrews and look at faith versus pleasure as we continue in there. All right, lots to do. Here we go.
Every day, somewhere in the world, a movie is slipping through the cracks. Every year, hundreds are lost and forgotten. But one man refuses to let them fall into darkness. One man risks everything to bring them back into the light. That man is Ken from Honolulu.
Hello, this is Ken from Honolulu with a movie review. This review contains spoilers. The movie is Big Ass Spider, made in 2013, directed by Mike Mendez, starring Steve Grunberg as Alec Mathis, Ray Wise as Major Paxton Tanner, Claire Kramer as Lieutenant Carly Brandt, Lombardo Boyar as Jose Ramos. Synopsis. A giant alien spider escapes from a military lab and rampages the city of Los Angeles. When a massive military strike fails, it's up to a team of scientists and one clever exterminator to kill a creature before the city is destroyed. Review. I give this a quality score of 6. And a relevant score of 2. I mean, it is about a spider attacking a city. Quality score of 6 is because the CG is absolutely horrible. It's not anywhere near believable. The acting is fair, but it is acceptable. So, if you're watching the movie for any deeper thoughts, then you're going to be very disappointed. If you're watching the movie to be entertained, then this is the movie for you. This movie has no real profanity, no sex, but is extremely violent. I didn't care for the film for that portion of it. It was just unnecessary violence in my estimation. Example, the spider comes out into a park and kills people, but instead of just kind of killing them, like stomping them or something, it spears them, and you get to see that in graphic detail. It's just not necessary in my estimation for a good film. Giant insect films have been made since the starting of films, when they first started out, and they generally followed along with the scare of the times. In the 1950s, it was Leo G. Carroll and Tarantula for the atomic age, because the spider got irradiated and then grew to enormous size. Then in the 2000s, there was movies like The Eight-Legged Freaks, where it was chemicals. And now it's Big Ass Spider with genetic manipulation. The film is fun. It is a standard anti-hero type of movie with the hero, a sidekick, and eventually he gets the girl. So it follows, you know, nothing special there. What makes it fun is the fact that you're introduced to the exterminator right away, and you're introduced to him being a really nice guy and just a nice Joe. When you meet him, he's helping this old lady catch a rat that her cat just couldn't catch. And she says to him, "Oh, I don't have any money to pay you. My social security check is late." And she hands him like a fruitcake or something like that. He says, "Well, thank you very much. He's very sweet about it." Then he tosses it into his truck where he's got a few more on the front seat. So it's not like this is the first time. So you're introduced to him right away as being a nice guy. Then you're introduced to the sidekick, who happens to be a security guard at the hospital where the spider shows up the first time. He's a Mexican, and he's got a heavy accent, so they make fun of that. Then you're introduced to the lieutenant, the female lieutenant, who's the love interest. And she saves him by shooting at the spider, doesn't actually hit the spider. And the spider goes down the drain, and the race is on. What it is there is a very top-secret military unit that's tracking this spider because it got away, because of a genetic experiment, got away from him. And they're using all this high-tech equipment and surveillance equipment. And the exterminator is using his knowledge of insects and spiders to track the spider. And they usually end up at the same place at the same time, which is kind of fun. And, of course, it's the exterminator at the end of the day that has to save the day, pretty much, before the spider lays its eggs and then there's nothing but genetic mutant spiders everywhere. So if you're looking for a very thought-provoking film, then pass this one up. If you're looking for a film that's entertaining, then this is the film for you. This is not a film for kids, I'd say under 13 or thereabouts, or people who get nightmares because of the extreme violence of the film. But otherwise, it's a fun film. Thank you for listening to my review. Aloha.
I want to remind you guys, go check out the other members of the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, the Untold podcast, and POSTOS. For more information about the CGC network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com. Every now and then people ask me what's on my mind, so I thought I'd take a minute to answer that question. Now, pay attention, please, because I don't think I can do this more than once. All right, this part is my parietal lobe, and if I dig back in here, I can pull out some of my occipital. And I don't know what this part is, but whenever I touch it, I smell peanut butter. All right, I just want to quickly mention this. Most of this audio is taken from the retro Summer of Free live stream that I did, and I just kind of ranted on the topic of New 52 and Superman for a little while, so that's why you're hearing, you're going to hear a lot of Final Fantasy III music in the background for most of this, so sorry about that. Hope you enjoy.
You know, going back to, I guess, DC Universe, talking about the New 52, my main complaints is that I think that they are just trying to appeal to their audience rather than tell the best stories they can. And I think the specific audience they're trying to appeal to is a younger audience. And I just wonder if they're guessing correctly what that audience wants. You know, among the changes they made with the New 52 were to basically wipe out the Justice Society of America and replace them with younger versions of themselves. One of which was gay, so I mean they're kind of like I feel like they're trying to check off a bunch of demographic boxes, you know. I mean, I remember before the New 52 launched, how much they were talking about at these panels, which they used to put up as a podcast online, the San Diego Comic-Con panels. People, like, it seemed like every fifth person that had a question, it was something about diversity and wanting more diversity. And I'm just wondering if they, if that's what all, you know, that's that represents a true percentage of readers that really want, care about, like, I want a wheelchair-bound character, I want a lesbian character, I want a Latino character, I want, you know, whatever. And I'm all for diversity, but it just feels like that they maybe got too focused on trying to check these demographic boxes and please different people and stuff, that it just isn't, it's not, doesn't make for the best stories that they could possibly be telling. And, you know, so the older generation of characters in DC is now gone. And it's, they also kind of reset the continuity so that all of the heroes, the, like, even the big ones like Superman and Batman, have now only been around for about 5 years. They're only 5 years into their superhero careers. So, like, Flash, Green Lantern, Superman, all these guys are relatively new at the hero thing. And so they lose all of their experience and the confidence that comes from that experience and the lessons they've learned, the wisdom they've picked up. And so a lot of them were reading, like, very much the same characters to me. Like, they were just insecure and trying to figure out how to live life as a superhero or whatever. And I'm like, you're telling the same story with every single one of these characters. And the ones where they weren't doing that, like, say, Superman and Batman, which had some, you know, unique things going on, were all in the wrong directions. Batman, as I said before, was all, like, about, you know, the surrogate family and getting, you know, becoming emotionally stable and psychologically stable, you know. And, and Superman has been, since day one of this reboot, brooding, and I have yet to see a panel of Superman smiling. He's always angry. He's angry at somebody. And it's like, you know, Superman should not be a person that I would not want my child to be around. Like, I would feel afraid for my child's safety around this Superman if he existed in the real world. You know, and Superman is the last character you should be able to say that of. But he's about the first one I would say that of in the New 52. So, it's some major blunders with that character. And now there is no, like, there's no paragon of virtue and justice, and there's no hero character that resembles what Superman was in the DC Universe now. That I'm aware of, because I stopped reading the New 52 about a year. I was finally done with every single New 52 comic. A year into New 52, I think I was finally done. I was like, no, they are not going to right this boat. And so it's just kind of been a mess, and I don't even think they know what they're doing. Because when I watched, and I mentioned this on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, but when I watched and took in coverage of Comic-Con and the announcements that DC had, at least half of what they had to talk about was promoting other media that their characters are featured in, like video games and movies primarily. The rest was all these, like, one-shot stories that are coming up that are about alternate reality versions of the DC universe. Or they are gimmick stories that are changing the status quo in an obviously temporary way. So I'm like, they don't have a plan right now, it doesn't look like, for how they can really make their core universe, not all these alternate reality versions of their core universe or these temporary gimmick changes to the status quo. You know, they don't have a plan that I'm seeing to really make their core main universe one that I am going to be interested at all in reading. They're just resorting to gimmicks and distractions. One of the biggest of which, I think, is Superman having his identity revealed to the world. The fact that it was by Lois Lane, I know that bothers some people or they find it ironic or whatever. I don't really care at the end of the day. But you take that away, and you've lost what Superman was intended to be from day one. When Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster created the character, they wanted to create a character that represented them and people like them who they, you know, they were Jewish immigrants and they felt like they were overlooked and they had no place in society. And so they created this character, and the whole concept was, you know, people don't think we're anything special. Girls don't think anything of us. But what if secretly we were amazing? What if underneath we were so much more than they assumed by looking at us on the surface? That was the whole concept of Superman. And it's gone now. There's no potential for that because the Clark Kent identity is useless. So it just seems like a shock tactic, like the stories they used to tell in the 90s, you know, like when they first killed Superman. Oh my gosh, Superman is dead! And then they noticed how many comics they sold, and like, oh my gosh, Batman's back is broken! And Green Lantern's gone totally bonkers, and he's killing everybody! That's what they did, these shock value, gimmicky stories in the 90s. And I feel like this is a return to that. You know, like they cannot possibly maintain... They might even think they will, but they cannot possibly maintain forever this whole, the glasses are off for good. That's what they said in their promo, is the glasses are off for good now, but I cannot see how they can maintain that. People, I think, will eventually want Clark Kent back, or they will eventually realize what they threw away when they got rid of the secret identity. You know, you might say to yourself, well, how... That's a stupid thing. How could it work? How could Lois Lane not know? I think that that concept works by finding the halfway point between suspension of disbelief, which audiences have to do to some degree when you're dealing with comic book stories, and then also changing how Clark Kent is portrayed. You know, the Christopher Reeve nerdy Clark Kent, or certainly the Clark Kent that's been in the comics for a long time, which is basically he's just kind of quiet and he has glasses. That's the only difference between him and Superman in the comics since like the 90s. Maybe even like since the late 80s. And really, the Christopher Reeve's uber nerdy, that's the right direction to go in. And it's more reflective of, you know, who he originally was in his creation. By Siegel and Schuster. But what I would like to see, and I'm going to stop playing, I'm sorry, I'm just going to talk about this and get it out of my system, then I'll get back to the game. What I would like to see is for them to update what kind of nerd he is. Okay, the 1950s pocket protector nerd that like Christopher Reeve was going for, oh, what a wonderful performance, and I still love watching it. But that's not the kind of nerd that we really think of when we think of nerd today. We think of a guy that's really socially awkward. He has greasy, nasty hair. And he's got some kind of maybe a speech impediment of some kind. He's really awkward to talk to. Maybe he talks too much and about totally weird things, you know. And he stays up all night playing World of Warcraft. And he does nothing but play D&D on the weekends. And he's got bad breath and horrible hygiene. You just don't want to... Like, this super uber awkward uber nerd. That is the uber nerd of today, you know? Someone who is just, like, socially, like, you know, all those things. And the way you make Clark Kent work... And I wish they would have done this in the movies, but we've seen in the trailer that they're not going for this Clark Kent. They're going for the freaking, you know, 80s and 90s, like, could be a model out of GQ version of Clark Kent. But this Clark Kent, no. He wears loose-fitting clothing, so you can't see his physique, or it certainly at least de-emphasizes it. And he certainly slouches, and he doesn't make eye contact with people... and he's very awkward and difficult to talk to the point where people would not want to talk to him, okay? And so you could justify people like, okay, hey, Clark, see him from across the room. I'm going the other way. His breath stinks. His hair's all greasy. You can't see half of his face, maybe. I don't know. Well, you can't have long hair just as Clark, I guess. I don't know how they would do that. I guess maybe you could have that halfway long hair. It could come down into his eyes a little bit and then be slicked back or something. I don't know. I'll let them work that out. But he's a guy, and he Coke bottle lenses, so his eyes are totally distorted. It's not just that he has glasses, but his eyes look totally distorted because they're these huge, super thick lenses. And then you make him a reporter that works from home. He's not in the office, you know. And he sends in, he only has a really bad picture if it's ever associated with his work on the website or the print newspaper or whatever. But there are things that you could do to make the uber nerd Clark Kent not only work, but work better than it ever has before. And not only that, but that kind of nerd, he would be the nerd, uber nerd outcast that no one gives a second thought to, who is in fact the person that everyone looks up to. You know, that would be a fantasy that would capture the hearts of nerds. You know, you talk about why is Superman such a hard character to write? It's because they've been getting Clark Kent wrong for years. For years. Superman becomes the most exciting character to write if you get Clark Kent right. And they've been screwing up Clark Kent for years. All right, in the middle of editing this, I just realized I wanted to expand on one of my thoughts. I said that he would be a really fascinating character if you wrote him this way. And I think that's because of the sacrifice that he would have to make as Clark Kent. You know, why would he go to all this trouble? Because he doesn't want to wear a mask as Superman. He wants to be someone that people are not afraid of, that people can relate to, you know, that people can feel safe around. And so what's the sacrifice to that? He has to have this completely false identity and look like a not just a buffoon, but just like be repulsive maybe to be around or really uncomfortable to be around. He has to just basically sacrifice his entire life, in a sense, in order to do this. And I think that's where a lot of the great storytelling could be done, because he doesn't have to be like this paragon of virtue that's like, I must do this for the good of the people. No, he can be someone who is dedicated to doing what's right, but who is having a really hard time doing it, you know, who struggles maybe with loneliness, you know, who is sad when he is overlooked and underappreciated. And that is like a huge element of who this character could be to so many people, because how many fans of comic books, myself included, so often feel overlooked, underappreciated, misunderstood, cast out, you know? And Superman could once again be the model superhero that represents what all superheroes, you know, are kind of about, and which is about this fantasy of what if I was more than people think I am, you know, or that I think I am, you know. It could be such a fascinating, fascinating story. And, you know, as we're going through that journey with him, as it's hard for him to make the right choices, and it's a story of sacrifice, you know, and in a sense, I mean, this wouldn't have to be the goal and people wouldn't have to see this, but I mean, as a nice side effect from a Christian standpoint, it would be a great model of what Christ did, you know, about he set aside, you know, the honor that was due him. The respect that was due him. He let go of his rights as the God of the universe and lived humbly and sacrificed his life for us, both in the end and day to day. He just lived his life for other people and set aside his own desires, you know. And so this would be just a fantastic and really interesting character. And even setting that aside, because that's, you know, it's not going to resonate with a lot of people, but I think just like non-Christians would just find this to be such a fascinating character that they could really feel for and empathize with, but at the same time look up to, you know, want to be like, you know, man, this, he would just be such a fascinating, fascinating character that everyone, I think, could really relate to. And you might say to yourself, like, well, if he's holed away and stuff, I mean, how could he be doing the whole reporter thing? I would say in this scenario, he lets Lois Lane be the star reporter. Like, he is a reporter just enough to have access to the alerts about, you know, dangers going on, tragedies taking place that he needs to address. He would be just connected enough so that he could have the inside track on stuff that's going on that as Superman he needs to go take care of. But aside from that, he's writing just like crap articles on stupid, boring stuff in the background. He's not in the office and stuff like that, you know. So I think that's, again, that's part of the sacrifice that he makes. You know, he lets someone else have the glory, someone else have the attention, someone else have the honor, even though he is so capable. So you add all this together, all these things that just keep stacking one on top of the other, all the stuff that he is sacrificing that makes him a character that's so easy to sympathize with. I think you need three personas. You need Superman, you need Clark Kent as he is in public, and then you need what I would call Kal-El. And that's Clark as he is on the farm, as he is with Martha and Jonathan Kent, who should both be alive, because you can also tell stories that you're not seeing told in any other comics when you have this unique relationship of Clark Kent having a healthy relationship as an adult with his parents who are still alive. Man, there are so many unique stories that can be told with that kind of dynamic. The problem is, I suspect that because of this, statistically, 50% of marriages in America end in divorce, you just don't have probably writers on staff that are familiar with that kind of dynamic, that kind of relationship dynamic. Statistically, those writers probably come from either broken homes or they don't have good relationships with their parents as adults, you know, or there's some kind of, you know, something. You just don't find that. It's so rare. And so when you have creative teams changing and stuff, I don't know how you can't maintain that. How can you expect to maintain that kind of interesting dynamic when maybe Jeff Johns or such and such a writer knows how to write that kind of dynamic, but nobody else does on staff, you know? So I think I understand why that's not working. It's such a bummer. Anyway.
The truth will set you free.
Truth is that which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. Now, lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
Well, in this segment, I attempt to examine the Bible and dissect some of what I would call the churchy language that we tend to take for granted, digging into history and languages when I'm able to try and get at the heart of the text so we can hopefully see and apply some of what God has for us in these words today. I'm not formally trained in Scripture. I'm just a guy using resources and a questioning mind to try and get at the truth, and that's something that you can do as well, and I hope you'll join me in that. This time we're looking at Hebrews 11, verses 13 through 16 as we make our way through the book of Hebrews. And in the ESV, those verses read, "These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return, but as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city." Okay, well, the author of Hebrews has spent most of this chapter so far giving us examples of faith in action. Abel trusted his well-being to God so much that he gave God his best prophets. Enoch trusted that God would set everything right one day. We see that about Enoch in Jude 1, verses 14 and 15. And in the meantime, Enoch chose to walk through day-to-day life with Yahweh as his trusted companion. And his faith pleased God so much that God spared him from physical death. Despite being surrounded by people who lived radically different from him and indulged in every sin they desired, Noah trusted that living life God's way was best, and trusted him when he said the unthinkable would happen. Abraham trusted God enough to leave behind his comfortable life and societal connections and follow God to a completely unknown place where he would spend the rest of his life. And so now these verses 13 through 16 reflect on those examples of faith. Look at verse 13. All of these people had at least one thing in common. They all died trusting in God despite not yet receiving what's called the things promised. Now, this might seem confusing at a glance. I mean, Abraham didn't inherit the land promised to him, so that makes sense. But what were Abel, Enoch, and Noah promised that they didn't receive? Well, whatever the promises were, these men saw them and greeted them from afar, this text says. And along with that, they also, the text says, acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. So now moving forward into verses 14 and 15, verse 14 clarifies that these men were all seeking a homeland and refused to return to the land from which they had gone out, it says. But the promised land was not promised until Abraham came along. You know, Abel didn't go anywhere. Noah didn't leave his land except as a side effect of surviving the flood. So what does this mean, that they were seeking a homeland and they refused to return to the land from which they had gone out? Well, verse 16 finally, I think, clarifies that they were looking for a heavenly country to settle in and call their home. The Greek word for heavenly or heaven didn't just mean like a wonderful, perfect place. It refers to the dwelling place of God. The common tie between all these men was their trust that life lived with God is the greatest thing to both pursue now and place their hope in for the future. And it was a huge amount of trust that they placed in him. Despite their sin and failures, these men had a trust in God that pleased him so much that he began identifying himself with them. Verse 16 says he was not ashamed to be called, you know, their God. Did I read that? Let's see. Yeah. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. And Exodus 3:6 is an example of that. In the ESV, it says, "And he said, I am the God of your father." And then he goes on to say, "the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. So God is, you know, not ashamed to identify himself with these people who understood what he wanted. He wanted their trust in him. He's like, these guys get it. They get what I'm about in terms of my relationship with humanity, so I'm going to identify with their example. So at this point, we might ask, what's in this for geeks? I try to ask myself that question every time, we go through this segment. Usually when I think about trusting God, my mind gravitates toward like big, time-sensitive decisions involving risk or being stuck in a bad situation in which I need to trust God, a situation I don't see a way out of. But these men all exercised faith in God before they were in trouble. They weren't counting on comfort or pleasure to bring them fulfillment, even though it was within reach of them. They were instead counting on God for that, even if fulfillment didn't come in their lifetime. And I think about that, and I think about my life, you know, I notice that sometimes I feel like I just need, I say, to buy the next cool release coming up of whatever, you know, movie, game, book, whatever. It could be any number of things. But sometimes I just feel like I need to buy that next cool release coming up that I don't responsibly have money for, you know, or I need to devote time to some kind of personal hobby or endeavor, even if that means neglecting my family a little bit. Every week before heading out to help lead the college ministry at our church, I seriously ask myself, just very quickly, okay, do I have a legitimate excuse not to go tonight so that I can avoid what is always a draining, though still largely enjoyable, experience? And it's pretty rare when I can find that excuse, but I always, you know, at least there's just this moment where my mind flits and goes, anything? Nope. All right, here we go. But I always check. Maybe you feel like you need to do something, you know, like I've listed already, or maybe you feel the need to play pirated games or watch pirated movies because, you know, not doing so is going to mean that your entertainment life vanishes. As shallow and infantile as it feels for me to admit, I sometimes fear that I will like have this depressing life if I don't fulfill these things that I call needs. But when I fear the idea of missing out on pleasure, I'm actually saying I don't trust that God's way is the best. I don't trust that God's way is worth it. You know, God doesn't promise that his way is going to be more pleasurable, but he does promise that it's worth it. And what I'm saying when I reject that and I say, you know what, I'm just going to choose this pleasure, even though it means doing something that I know is not the best choice right now. I'm saying that, you know what, I don't trust that God's way is worth it. Now I want to be clear. The Bible does not teach that pleasure is bad or a waste of time. If you've been listening to this podcast, I think you know that already, but maybe you're still kind of new to the show. We are to enjoy leisure time and possessions, if we're able. We see that in Ecclesiastes 5, 18 through 20. That's a good thing. And while doing that, we're to recognize God as the source of everything good we experience. Looking around my room at the comic books, the games, the things that I enjoy, it's worthwhile for me to see those things and reflect on just kind of the joy, the pleasure, the excitement that they give me, and then recognize, you know what, God brought that about. That's the result of his gifting of people. I think we see that in James 1:17. But pleasure is a lower calling than loving and serving God and loving and serving those around us. And I think we see that in Mark 12, verses 28 through 31. And so we should set aside pleasure when a better opportunity presents itself. Just last weekend, my wife lovingly confronted me about a pattern of neglect she has seen when it comes to the time I give my family. It seems like once about every 6 to 9 months, she has to come and bring this issue or something very similar to it to my attention. And I think each time she does, my first thought is,
that she doesn't understand. She doesn't get me. She doesn't understand what I need. And it's true that there are some things about me she doesn't understand or relate to, and some compromises between us that has to happen. But she's still right about my tendency to neglect her and our boys in favor of, you know, my me time, my video game time, or you know, whatever. So what I do when after those conversations is I talk to God and I change my mind. You know, I talked last week that's the concept of repentance. I change my mind. I repent about what I've been doing. I realize, you know, no, this is wrong. There is something better that I should be moving toward. And then I make some changes in my routine to put my trust in God into action. And guess what? I'm not depressed. I fear that going in. It's like, this is going to suck, but I'm just going to trust, you know, that even if it is difficult in the moment, my life is not going to be miserable, you know, or depressing or insanely boring or whatever, you know. But I find almost immediately, most times, that I'm not depressed. My life did not turn into a dreary grind. I still have lots of geeky fun, and on top of that, I feel the satisfaction and different flavor of pleasure that comes with spending more time talking to my wife and more time playing with my boys. Yes, sometimes the investment is a drag and does cost what feels like a lot, and you don't feel that, you know, immediate payoff of choosing the better option. But it's rarely what I fear it will be, and it almost always comes with pleasure or fulfillment that I didn't expect. So I guess the question I would leave you and myself with to kind of think about is, what pleasure do you think God may be calling you to either let go of or do less of in favor of something else he has for you, some other option he's presenting to you? Why not go to the forums at ChristianGeekCentral.com and ask for some prayer as you face that crossroad? Feedback. Give me your thoughts on this podcast, Christian Geek Central, the YouTube channel, or anything else we're doing. You know, what should we keep? What should we change? What's on your mind that you'd like a potentially uninformed opinion on? We want to make this show and all of Christian Geek Central as fun and as useful as we can, but we have to hear from you to do that. You can send me an email at paeter@spiritblade.net. All right, well, I want to say again that we really need to fill the tech admin position for the Christian Geek Central forums. So if you're, like, you know, pretty good with troubleshooting tech stuff related to, you know, the functionality of websites and stuff, I don't think you'll need to know, like, coding necessarily, but anyway, if that kind of activity would be not a big drag for you or even appeal to you, please let me know. There's no discussion moderating that's required in that role. We just need a committed person to troubleshoot technical stuff, and this is just for the forums, the Christian Geek Central forums, and to find solutions for us. If you leave that to me, which right now I'm the only choice, really, it's just going to take a lot longer, and everything else that I do will suffer and take longer and be delayed as a result. So if you are interested in helping out in that, please email me, paeter@spiritblade.com. I also want to remind you guys that Extra Life is coming up November 7th, and I just formed a Christian Geek Central Extra Life team. You can find more information by following the link at the top of the page at agapegeekout.com, A-G-A-P-E, geekout.com. Also, if you haven't been to Christian Geek Central in a little while, Winston Crutchfield at the start of the month put up a new paper and pencil RPG scan that if you're interested in tabletop role-playing games, you definitely want to check out. And also, Nathan James Norman has released another episode of the Untold podcast that he's sharing with us, episode 40. Both of those you can find at ChristianGeekCentral.com. Also, if you would, promote this the YouTube video that I just put up, and maybe even send it to DC. I'm not quite so bold, but I mean, if you agree with what I shared today about fixing Superman and stuff like that, you could share those thoughts really easily and kind of cast your vote, as it were. By going to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral, and liking that video and maybe sending a link to it to somebody at DC or something. I should maybe put something there to make it a little bit easier for you guys. But anyway, or just share that video and kind of, you know, maybe we'll get some buzz. Maybe somebody will notice. And but I'm always looking for ways to kind of draw people to the conversation that you and I are already having through this podcast combined with the forums and email and other things like that. I'd love to draw other people, even sometimes non-believers, you know, I mean, they can't enter into the conversation in the same way that you and I can, but I do, you know, I want to welcome them to interact with the content that we're doing here. So anyway, like, share, subscribe. That always really helps to kind of grow our community. And of course, I want your voice and your interests to be a part of this podcast as always, and part of Christian Geek Central. So if you've got an idea already, or you just want to be part of the fun, we want to find a way to plug you in and let your voice be heard. And it's also a great way to promote what you're doing if you'd like. So for more info, please email me at paeter@spiritblade.com. Well, Programmers Day is coming up September 13th. I hope you enjoy that. And on the same day, we celebrate the Super Mario Brothers 1 Japanese release, which was September 13th of 1985. And then if you're into video game stuff, take a look at YouTube. Not the Christian Geek Central channel in particular, but the Tokyo Game Show is going on this 17th through the 20th, so I'm sure there'll be some cool coverage online that you can watch for that. Stay tuned for Farscape Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 310 if you want to start from the beginning. I want to thank Ken from Honolulu for sending in that review today. Thank you very much, Ken. Next week, if God wants it to happen, I'm going to share a review of Maze Runner, The Scorch Trials. Till then, check out SpiritBlade.com and Christian Geek Central for more stuff made just for you. Thank you guys so much for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week and that you'll join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Frampton with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.com. Thank you for listening.
Prepare for immediate starburst.
All right, now we're going to be talking about episode 402 of Farscape, What Was Lost, Part 1. And one thing I forgot to mention last time that I want to mention right now before I forget is that Season 4 is in widescreen. And, you know, I've been watching this because about a year ago, a year and several months ago, I got this series on Blu-ray. And it's not a huge improvement because of the master files for this show having been lost. I'm still hoping that someday they'll recover those. It's been hard because this show started before widescreen was like the norm, but not long before it was the norm. It was like on the air during the transition of many shows over to widescreen. And I don't remember now if it was one of the first shows to do that, or if it was just kind of on average going to widescreen when other shows were. But it's still a bummer for it to be just on the cusp. You know, I can almost understand, you know, going back and watching old sitcoms, or, you know, watching like the old Highlander TV series or something. You know, I'm a little bit more accepting of that because the filmmaking itself is aged a bit, and so for some reason my mind is a little bit more okay with it. But it's hard for me to go back and watch the first three seasons of Farscape and for this huge, imaginative, very cinematically filmed world to be in that old
TV format, you know, and it's a little bit bittersweet that it goes to widescreen in the fourth season, because I think that the third season is the strongest season of Farscape, and I would love to have had, you know, be able to go back and have that experience in widescreen, you know. But, you know, I'll take it now that they have it, and I'm very grateful for it, and it certainly does add a little bit, you know, just one more little bit to the cinematic quality of the show. Okay, now here's something that's a real shame. If you've got the DVD and you haven't yet, go back and watch the deleted scenes for Crichton Kicks, specifically deleted scenes 58A through 58C. There is a subplot that was filmed for Crichton Kicks that was deleted from that episode. Every time I watch What Was Lost Part 1 and I watch that opening previously on Farscape, I get confused every time because they are showing clips from scenes in the previous episode that were not aired. And so, I mean, from the first time that episode aired, I was like, did I miss an episode? I don't remember this. And that's really unfair of them to say previously on Farscape. You know, they should have figured out some other way, you know, to communicate that idea, because it makes you feel like you missed an episode. But they cram that bit of plot information there because they need to establish that Bracca has been manipulated by Graeza away from his loyalty for Scorpius, and now he is allied with Commandant Graeza. And that's a huge plot point for that character and for Scorpius and for Graeza. And so, first of all, poo on them for deleting that from Crichton Kicks. You know, usually I don't bother watching the deleted scenes when I go through, you know, these viewings through the entire show. Maybe every other time I'll watch the bonus features as I go through as well. But this is one that I need to remember. You gotta watch those scenes, Pater. Because they just goofed. That was just a bad move on their part. So anyway, if you still have the DVD that has the episode Crichton Kicks, hopefully it has the deleted scenes on it. If, I don't know if Netflix keeps all the bonus features on there or not or whatever, but and check that out. Otherwise, you're going to feel as lost as I do every single time when the previously on Farscape stuff runs for this episode, 402. And if you've already watched 402, you've already felt lost. I can't help you. Sorry. Now, despite this episode and the one following it not being favorites of mine, I really do think season 4 gets off to a slow start. This two-parter and the story is important, and it's relevant to the miniseries that caps things off. No spoilers, but I mean, just take note of what they're talking about here and the significance of this planet and what happened on this planet. You know, that it is a place that discovered peace thousands of years ago, the secret to peace, you know, and then also, what else? Oh yeah, in that flashback that Narranti causes John to see, where he sees the ancient world, you see these priests, and they're singing this chant, and it's the Farscape theme, and I think that's just kind of like a musical cue that says to us, ooh, this is significant. Like, they're singing the Farscape theme, which kind of, I think, evokes the idea of this story that's being told and this ancient world that they're on is significant to the entire series, to the entire television series. And I really didn't take note of that the first time I watched this. I didn't really appreciate that. And then when there was a call back to this in the miniseries, it was like, oh, really? They're taking us back to think about that. They're calling back to that episode. Those episodes weren't that great. Why are they doing a callback to those two episodes, you know? So anyway, I just want to put out there that if you take note of this story a little bit, you might be able to anticipate and appreciate the series as a whole a little bit better, and the miniseries, which really was an attempt to include the plots that they had intended to have unravel over the course of two more seasons of Farscape. So if you haven't seen this one in a while, this is one where Crichton's still aboard the old Leviathan with Chiana and Rigel, is reunited with Jewel and Dargo, who were on Dargo's ship, and found, I can't even remember how they got to this planet, but they just found this planet where there was a dig going on, that's only possible every, I don't know how many hundreds or thousands or whatever the crap of years while the magnetics of the planet are aligned properly. Otherwise, it's, you know, uninhabitable. And there's a big secret. You know, this is the home of an ancient civilization that had discovered the secret to peace. And so archaeologists are trying to figure out what happened to that ancient civilization, which just disappeared, and what their secret to peace was, so that they can bring peace to the universe or whatever. And so anyway, John's reunited with them on this planet. And I don't know, there's kind of like just kind of a plot of, I don't know, the story's really not that memorable to me. You know, different people have motives. There's somebody that wants to kill the leader of the excavation, and the leader of the excavation is kind of a jerk and stuff, you know, so. But one point that just kind of popped out at me was when, you know, spoilers, the leader of the excavation, who's a jerk, she dies. Her name is like Vela or something like that, Instructor Vela. And Granny is praying kind of like over her graves, saying, receive the spirit of Instructor Vela, no matter how evil, no matter how selfish, I believe is what she says, you know. And you know, that's a beautiful thought, that there is hope after this life, even for us, as broken as we are as people, you know. But there's no basis being presented for, you know, why should I, you know, presumably she wants whoever to receive the spirit of Vela, because that would be a good thing for Vela, that there's a good place that Granny wants Vela to be able to go. Well, why should Vela go to the good place and just continue to be a jerk to everybody, you know, while she's there? That's not going to make that good place very good, you know. And I think this is just another example of how when we have these thoughts about the afterlife and we wish good things for people after this life, we're not really thinking through, you know, what the ramifications are of somebody that's, you know, just messed up, as we all are, entering into an eternal state with others who are existing eternally and still being messed up. I mean, is that really what we want? Is just to have another life after this one that's just like this one, except in that life, you never die. And so you don't have the fear of death, you know, hanging over you, and you can totally just fulfill. You have even more ability and motive to attempt to fulfill all of your desires, because death is no longer a threat to you. You can just cut loose, you know. So anyway, that's just kind of a thought there. I think that, you know, there's a lack of acknowledgement that we need cleaning up. We need repairing if we are going to be suitable for an eternal, never-ending existence alongside other people who are also going to be existing in that place forever. And of course, that's setting aside the whole idea of, you know, do we deserve to be in such a place? But just that's for the moment, that's just setting the whole like justice thing aside, and just like, you know, how will that work, and how will this eternity be a good place if we aren't fixed as we enter into it? Anyway, probably the best laugh in the episode, as hard as it was to see Scorpius tied to a leash and totally broken, and acting like a little broken dog. Oh, man, I hated seeing that. And I have thoughts on Grays. I'll talk about her, I think, at some point. But the biggest laugh in the episode was when she's like, you know, as a sign of goodwill, here's what I've done to Scorpius. Here, take him, do whatever you want with him. And he's just shaking his head and kind of laughing. He's like, no thanks. I don't think I could come up with anything better than that. I mean, it was just like, that is, you could just see in his eyes, like, that is jacked up, you know? Anyway, I guess I'll talk about Graysa just briefly now. This is already going longer than I intended. I don't like Graysa. She's not as strong as a villain, as Scorpius. Scorpius was a fascinating monster in addition to being a scarily unpredictable one. She is, I don't know, maybe not any more predictable, but she's not a mysterious monster to me, you know. She just reminds me, as I think she's intended to, of a woman who just uses her looks to get what she wants, and that's even implied, you know, in the deleted scenes that introduced her from Crichton Kicks, that she worked her way up through the ranks, you know, just through sex appeal and this weird cleavage sweat. Gross. That she uses to get men to just kind of do with whatever she wants them to do. You know, I think it helps that me not like her, that I've never found her attractive. She's way overly made up and just kind of gross to me, you know, but she's the type of attractive that, like, I would look at her and say, oh yeah, she's probably a lot of people's types or whatever, you know, or she probably is alluring to, you know, a lot of guys or something like that. Or maybe she just looks like she's easy or something, you know, I don't know. She's just kind of, ugh, she's just gross. I don't like her. And I feel like she is threatening in a way that is not the result of her being truly brilliant. She is not brilliant in the way that Scorpius is. She's very ambitious. And, you know, uncompromisingly maybe ambitious. But I don't think she's brilliant like Scorpius is. I'm not going to say anything more about Scorpius. So anyway, those are my feelings about Graeza. She's a good villain in that I hate her. And I think I hate her for reasons that the writers intended, probably. Unlike, say, other characters, you know, that I hate for reasons that you know, the authors did not intend, you know. Like Zan, you know. And maybe Jewel, you know. So I think I'm hating her for the reasons that the writers want me to. I just don't think, for my taste, she's not as interesting of a villain as Scorpius. And I think, ultimately, perhaps not as threatening. But I may rethink that as I remind myself of, you know, who she is and what she's capable of as the season goes on. So anyway, the old woman is convinced that Crichton, you know, has to die because he knows too much about the Darnez probe. And if the peacekeepers find that, they'll be able to have this big weapon of mass destruction or whatever the crap. So she sends him off the cliff. Of course, he falls into water and she acts like he's dead. But we all know that when people jump off cliffs or fall off cliffs and land in water, they are never dead. So we'll find out what happened to him specifically in part 2.